Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This evening we're reading two stories by Edith Wharton, Roman Fever and A Journey. Edith Wharton was the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for Literature in 1921 for The Age of Innocence. She also received an honorary doctorate from Yale in 1923 and was the first woman to claim that distinction. So it seems appropriate to read Edith Wharton on this International Women's Day. And now, two stories by Edith Wharton. Roman Fever by Edith Wharton. From the table at which they had been lunching, two American ladies of ripe but well-cared-for middle age moved across the lofty terrace of the Roman restaurant and, leaning on its parapet, looked first at each other and then down on the outspread glories of the Palatine and the Forum with the same expression of vague but benevolent approval. As they leaned there, a girlish voice echoed up gaily from the stairs leading to the court below. "Well, come along, then," it cried, not to them, but to an invisible companion. "And let's leave the young things to their knitting." And a voice, as fresh, laughed back. "Oh, look here, Babs, not actually knitting." "Well, I mean figuratively," joined the first. "After all, we haven't left our poor parents much else to do." At that point, the turn of the stairs engulfed the dialogue. The two ladies looked at each other again, this time with a tinge of smiling embarrassment, and the smaller and paler one shook her head and colored slightly. "Barbara," she murmured, sending an unheard rebuke after the mocking voice in the stairway. The other lady, who was fuller and higher in color, with a small determined nose supported by vigorous black eyebrows, gave a good-humored laugh. "That's what our daughters think of us." Her companion replied in a deprecating gesture. "Not of us individually, we must remember that. It's just the collective modern idea of mothers. And you see?" Half guiltily she drew from her handsome mounted black handbag a twist of crimson silk run through by two fine knitting needles. "One never knows," she murmured. "The new system has certainly given us a good deal of time to kill, and sometimes I get tired just looking, even at this." Her gesture was now addressed to the stupendous scene at their feet. The dark lady laughed again, and they both relapsed upon the view, contemplating it in silence with a sort of diffused serenity which might have been borrowed from the spring effulgence of the Roman skies. The luncheon hour was long past, and the two had their end of the vast terrace to themselves. At its opposite extremity, a few groups, detained by a lingering look at the outspread city, were gathering up guidebooks and fumbling for tips. The last of them scattered, and the two ladies were alone on the air-washed height. "Well, I don't see why we should just stay here," said Mrs. Slade, the lady of the high color and energetic brows. Two derelict basket chairs stood near, and she pushed them into the angle of the parapet and settled herself in one, her gaze upon the Palatine. "After all, it's still the most beautiful view in the world."
"It always will be, to me,"
assented her friend Mrs. Ansley, with so slight a stress on the "me" that Mrs. Slade, though she noticed it, wondered if it were not merely accidental, like the random underlinings of old-fashioned letter writers. "Grace Ansley was always old-fashioned," she thought, and added aloud with a retrospective smile, "It's a view we've both been familiar with for a good many years. When we first met here, we were younger than our girls now. You remember?"
"Oh, yes, I remember," murmured Mrs. Ansley, with the same undefinable stress. "Oh, there's that head waiter wondering," she extrapolated. She was evidently far less sure than her companion of herself and of her rights in the world. "I'll cure him of wondering," said Mrs. Slade, stretching her hand toward a bag as discreetly opulent-looking as Mrs. Ansley's. Signing to the head waiter, she explained that she and her friend were old lovers of Rome and would like to spend the end of the afternoon looking down on the view, that is, if it did not disturb the service. The head waiter, bowing over her gratuity, assured her that the ladies were most welcome, and would still be more so if they would condescend to remain for dinner. A full moon night, they would remember. Mrs. Slade's black brows drew together, as though references to the moon were out of place and even unwelcome. But she smiled away her frown as the head waiter retreated. "Well, why not? We might do worse. There's no knowing, I suppose, when the girls will be back. Do you even know back from where? I don't." Mrs. Ansley again colored slightly. "Oh, I think those young Italian aviators we met at the embassy invited them to fly to Tarquinia for tea. I suppose they'll want to wait and fly back by moonlight."
Moonlight. Moonlight. What a part it still plays. Do you suppose they're as sentimental as we were?
"I've come to the conclusion that I don't in the least know what they are," said Mrs. Ansley. "And perhaps we didn't know much more about each other."
"No, perhaps we didn't."
Her friend gave a shy glance. "I should never have supposed you were sentimental, Alida."
"Well, perhaps I wasn't."
Mrs. Slade drew her lids together in retrospect, and for a few moments the two ladies, who had been intimate since childhood, reflected how little they knew each other. Each one, of course, had a label ready to attach to the other's name. Mrs. Delphin Slade, for instance, would have told herself or anyone who asked her that Mrs. Horace Ansley, 25 years ago, had been exquisitely lovely.
"No, you wouldn't believe it, would you? Though, of course, still charming, distinguished."
Well, as a girl she had been exquisite, far more beautiful than her daughter, Barbara, though certainly Babs, according to the new standards at any rate, was more effective, had more edge, as they say. Funny where she got it, with those two nullities as parents.
Yes, Horace Ansley was, well, just the duplicate of his wife. Museum specimens of old New York. Good-looking, irreproachable, exemplary.
Mrs. Slade and Mrs. Ansley had lived opposite each other, actually as well as figuratively, for years. When the drawing-room curtains on No. 20 East 73rd Street were renewed, No. 23 across the way was always aware of it. And of all the movings, buyings, travels, anniversaries, illnesses, the tame chronicle of an estimable pair. Little of it escaped Mrs. Slade, but she had grown bored with it by the time her husband made his big coup in Wall Street, and, when they bought an Upper Park Avenue, had already begun to think,
"I'd rather live opposite a speakeasy for a change. At least one might see it raided." The idea of seeing Grace raided was so amusing that, before the move, she launched it at a woman's lunch. It made a hit and went the rounds. She sometimes wondered if it crossed the street and reached Mrs. Ansley. She hoped not, but didn't mind much. Those were the days when respectability was at a discount, and it did the irreproachable no harm to laugh at them a little. A few years later, and not many months apart, both ladies lost their husbands. There was an appropriate exchange of wreaths and condolences, and a brief renewal of intimacy in the half-shadow of their mourning. And now, after another interval, they had run across each other in Rome at the same hotel, each of them the modest appendage of a salient daughter. The similarity of their lot had again drawn them together, lending itself to mild jokes and the mutual confession that if in the old days it must have been tiring to keep up with daughters, it was now, at times, a little dull not to. No doubt, Mrs. Slade reflected, she felt her unemployment more than poor Grace ever would. It was a big drop from being the wife of Delphin Slade to being his widow,
She had always regarded herself with a certain conjugal pride as his equal in social gifts, as contributing her full share to the making of the exceptional couple they were. But the difference after his death was irremediable. As the wife of the famous corporate lawyer, always with an international case or two on hand, every day brought its exciting and unexpected obligation, the impromptu entertaining of eminent colleagues from abroad, the hurried dashes on legal business to London, Paris, or Rome, where the entertaining was so handsomely reciprocated, the amusement of hearing in her wakes, "What, that handsome woman with the good clothes and the eyes is Mrs. Slade, the Slade's wife? Really? Generally, wives of celebrities are such frumps." Yes, being the Slade's widow was a dullish business after that. In living up to such a husband, all her faculties had been engaged. Now she had only her daughter to live up to, for the son who seemed to have inherited his father's gifts had died suddenly in boyhood. She had fought through the agony because her husband was there, to be helped and to help. Now, after the father's death, the thought of the boy had become unbearable. There was nothing left but to mother her daughter, and dear Jenny was such a perfect daughter that she needed no excessive mothering. "Now, with Bab Annesley, I don't know that I should be so quiet," Mrs. Slade, sometimes half-envious, reflected. But Jenny, who was younger than her brilliant friend, was that rare accident, an extremely pretty girl who somehow made youth and prettiness seem as safe as their absence. It was all perplexing, and to Mrs. Slade a little boring. She wished that Jenny would fall in love, with the wrong man even, that she might have to be watched, outmaneuvered, rescued. And instead, it was Jenny who watched her mother, kept her out of drafts, made sure she had taken her tonic. Mrs. Annesley was much less articulate than her friend, and her mental portrait of Mrs. Slade was slighter and drawn with fainter touches. "Alida Slade's awfully brilliant, but not as brilliant as she thinks," would have summed it up. Though she would have added, for the enlightenment of strangers, that Mrs. Slade had been an extremely dashing girl, much more so than her daughter, who was pretty, of course, and clever in a way, but had none of her mother's, well, vividness, someone had once called it. Mrs. Annesley would take up current words like this and cite them in quotation marks as unheard-of audacities. No, Jenny was not like her mother. Sometimes Mrs. Annesley thought Alida Slade was disappointed. On the whole, she had had a sad life, full of failures and mistakes. Mrs. Annesley had always been rather sorry for her. So these two ladies visualized each other, each through the wrong end of her little telescope. For a long time, they continued to sit side by side without speaking. It seemed as though to both there was a relief in laying down their somewhat futile activities in the presence of the vast memento mori which faced them. Mrs. Slade sat quite still, her eyes fixed on the golden slope of the Palace of the Caesars, and after a while Mrs. Annesley ceased to fidget with her bag, and she too sank into meditation. Like many intimate friends, the two ladies had never before had occasion to be silent together, and Mrs. Annesley was slightly embarrassed by what seemed, after so many years, a new stage in their intimacy, and one with which she did not yet know how to deal. Suddenly the air was full of that deep clangor of bells which periodically covers Rome with a roof of silver. Mrs. Slade glanced at her watch. 5 o'clock already, she said, as though surprised. Mrs. Annesley suggested interrogatively, "There's a bridge at the embassy at 5. For a long time, Mrs. Slade did not answer. She appeared to be lost in contemplation, and Mrs. Annesley thought the remark had escaped her. But after a while, she said, as if speaking out of a dream, "Bridge, did you say? Not unless you want to. But I don't think I will, you know." "Oh, no," Mrs. Annesley hastened to assure her. "I don't care to at all. It's so lovely here and so full of memories, as you say.
She settled herself in her chair and almost furtively drew forth her knitting. Mrs. Slade took sideways notice of this activity, but her own beautifully cared for hands remained motionless on her knee.
I was just thinking, she said slowly, what different things Rome stands for to each generation of travelers. To our grandmothers, Roman fever. To our mothers, sentimental dangers. How we used to be guarded. To our daughters, no more dangerous than the middle of Main Street. They don't know it, but how much they're missing.
The long golden light was beginning to pale, and Mrs. Ansley lifted her knitting a little closer to her eyes.
Yes, how we were guarded.
I always used to think, Mrs. Slade continued, that our mothers had a much more difficult job than our grandmothers. When Roman fever stalks the streets, it must have been comparatively easy to gather in the girls at the danger hour. But when you and I were young, with such beauty calling us, and the spice of disobedience thrown in, and no worse risk than catching cold during the cool hour after sunset, the mothers used to be put to it to keep us in, didn't they?
She turned again toward Mrs. Ansley, but the latter had reached a delicate point in her knitting.
One, two, three, slip two.
Yes, they must have been, she assented without looking up. Mrs. Slade's eyes rested on her with a deepened attention.
She can knit in the face of this. How like her.
Mrs. Slade leaned back, brooding, her eyes ranging from the ruins which faced her to the long green hollow of the forum, the fading glow of the church fronts beyond it, and the outlying immensity of the Colosseum. Suddenly she thought,
it's all very well to say that our girls have gone away with sentiment and moonlight, but if Babs Ansley isn't out to catch that young aviator, the one who's a marquess, then I don't know anything. And Jenny has no chance beside her. I know that, too. I wonder if that's why Grace Ansley likes the two girls to go everywhere together. My poor Jenny as a foil!
Mrs. Slade gave a hardly audible laugh, and at the sound Mrs. Ansley dropped her knitting.
Yes? Nothing! I was only thinking how your Babs carries everything before her. That Campolieri boy is one of the best matches in Rome. Oh, don't look so innocent, my dear. You know he is. And I was wondering, ever so respectfully, you understand, wondering how two such exemplary characters as you and Horace had managed to produce anything quite so dynamic.
Mrs. Slade laughed again with a touch of asperity. Mrs. Ansley's hands lay inert across her needles. She looked straight out at the great accumulated wreckage of passion and splendor at her feet. But her small profile was almost expressionless. At length she said,
I think you overrate Babs, my dear.
Mrs. Slate's tone grew easier.
No, I don't. I appreciate her, and perhaps envy you. Oh, my girl's perfect. If I were a chronic invalid, Well, I think I'd rather be in Jenny's hands. There must be times. But there, I've always wanted a brilliant daughter, and never quite understood why I got an angel instead.
Mrs. Ansley echoed her laugh in a faint murmur.
Well, Babs is an angel, too.
Of course, of course. But she's got rainbow wings. Well, they're wandering by the sea with their young men. And here we sit, and it all brings back the past a little too acutely.
Mrs. Ansley had resumed her knitting. One might almost have imagined, if one had known her less well, Mrs. Slade reflected, that for her also too many memories rose from the lengthening shadows of those August ruins. But no, she was simply absorbed in her work.
What was there for her to worry about? She knew that Babs would almost certainly come back engaged to the extremely eligible Campolieri. And she'll sell the New York house and settle down near them in Rome and never be in their way. She's much too tactful.
But she'll have an excellent cook and just the right people in for bridge and cocktails, and a perfectly peaceful old age among her grandchildren."
Mrs. Slade broke off this prophetic flight with a recoil of self-disgust. There was no one whom she had less right to think unkindly than of Grace Ansley. Would she never cure herself of envying her? Perhaps she had begun too long ago. She stood up and leaned against the parapet, filling her troubled eyes with the tranquilizing magic of the hour. But instead of tranquilizing her, the sight seemed to increase her exasperation. Her gaze turned toward the Colosseum. Already its gold flank was drowned in purple shadow, and above it the sky curved crystal clear, without light or color. It was the moment when the afternoon and evening hang balanced in mid-heaven. Mrs. Slade turned back and laid her hand on her friend's arm. The gesture was so abrupt that Mrs. Ansley looked up, startled. "The sun set. You're not afraid, my dear."
"Afraid?"
"Of Roman fever or pneumonia? I remember how ill you were that winter. As a girl, you had a very delicate throat, hadn't you?"
"Oh, well, we're all right up here. Down below in the forum, it does get deathly cold, all of a sudden. But not here."
"Ah, of course, you know, because you had to be so careful." Mrs. Slade turned back to the parapet. She thought, "I must make one more effort not to hate her." Aloud, she said, "Whenever I look at the form from up here, I remember that story about a great aunt of yours, wasn't she? A dreadfully wicked great aunt?"
"Oh, yes, great aunt Harriet, the one who was supposed to have sent her young sister out to the form after sunset to gather a night-blooming flower for her album. All our great aunts and grandmothers used to have albums of dried flowers."
Mrs. Slade nodded. "But she really sent her because they were in love with the same man."
"Well, that was the family tradition. They said Aunt Harriet confessed it years afterward. At any rate, the poor little sister caught the fever and died. Mother used to frighten us with the story when we were children."
"And you frightened me with it, that winter when you and I were here as girls. The winter I was engaged to Delphin."
Mrs. Ansley gave a faint laugh.
"Oh, did I really frighten you? Oh, I don't believe you're easily frightened."
"Not often, but I was then. I was easily frightened because I was too happy. I wonder if you know what that means."
"I? Yes," Mrs. Ansley faltered.
"Well, I suppose that was why the story of your wicked aunt made such an impression on me. And I thought, there's no more Roman fever, but the forum is deathly cold after sunset, especially after a hot day, and the Colosseum's even colder and damper."
"The Colosseum?"
"Yes. It wasn't easy to get in after the gates were locked for the night. Far from easy. Still, in those days it could be managed. It was managed often. Lovers met there who couldn't meet anywhere else. You knew that?"
"Why, I dare say. I don't remember."
"You don't remember? You don't remember going to visit some ruins or another one evening, just after dark, and catching a bad chill? You were supposed to have gone to see the moon rise. People always said that expedition was what caused your illness."
There was a moment's silence. Then Mrs. Ansley rejoined,
"Did they? It was all so long ago."
"Yes. And you got well again, so it didn't matter. But I suppose it struck your friends, the reason given for your illness. I mean, because everybody knew you were so prudent on account of your throat, and your mother took such care of you. You had been out late sightseeing, hadn't you, that night?"
"Perhaps I had. The most prudent girls aren't always prudent." "What made you think of it now?"
Mrs. Slade seemed to have no answer ready, but after a moment she broke out,
"Because I simply can't bear it any longer."
Mrs. Ansley lifted her head quickly. Her eyes were wide and very pale.
"Can't bear what?"
"Why,
Your not knowing that I've always known why you went.
Why I went?
Yes. You think I'm bluffing, don't you? Well, you went to meet the man I was engaged to, and I can repeat every word of the letter that took you there.
While Mrs. Slade spoke, Mrs. Ansley had risen unsteadily to her feet. Her bag, her knitting, and gloves slid in a panic-stricken heap to the ground. She looked at Mrs. Slade as though she were looking at a ghost.
No, no, don't, she faltered out.
Why not? Listen, if you don't believe me. My darling, things can't go on like this. I must see you alone. Come to the Coliseum immediately after dark tomorrow. There will be somebody to let you in. No one whom you need fear will suspect.
But perhaps you've forgotten what the letter said.
Mrs. Ansley met the challenge with an unexpected composure. Steadying herself against the chair, she looked at her friend and replied,
No, I know it by heart, too.
And the signature?
Only your D.S. Was that it?
I'm right, am I?
That was the letter that took you out that evening after dark.
Mrs. Ansley was looking at her. It seemed to Mrs. Slade that a slow struggle was going on behind the voluntarily controlled mask of her small, quiet face.
I shouldn't have thought she had herself so well in hand, Mrs. Slade reflected, almost resentfully.
But at this moment, Mrs. Ansley spoke.
I don't know how you knew. I burnt that letter at once.
Yes, you would, naturally. You're so prudent.
The sneer was open now.
And if you burn the letter, you're wondering how on earth I know what was in it. That's it, isn't it?
Mrs. Slade waited, but Mrs. Ansley did not speak.
Well, my dear, I know what was in the letter because I wrote it.
You wrote it?
Yes.
The two women stood for a minute, staring at each other in the last golden light. Then Mrs. Ansley dropped back into her chair.
Oh, she murmured, and covered her face with her hands.
Mrs. Slade waited nervously for another word or movement. None came, and at length she broke out,
I horrify you.
Mrs. Ansley's hands dropped to her knees. The face they uncovered was streaked with tears.
I wasn't thinking of you. I was thinking it was the only letter I ever had from him.
And I wrote it. Yes, I wrote it. But I was the girl he was engaged to. Did you happen to remember that?
Mrs. Ansley's head drooped again.
I'm not trying to excuse myself. I remembered.
And still you went?
Still I went.
Mrs. Slade stood looking down on the small, bowed figure at her side. The flame of her wrath had already sunk, and she wondered why she ever thought there would be any satisfaction in inflicting so purposeless a wound on her friend. But she had to justify herself.
You do understand. I'd found out, and I hated you. Hated you! I knew you were in love with Delphin, and I was afraid. Afraid of you, of your quiet ways, your sweetness, your... Well, I wanted you out of the way, that's all. Just for a few weeks, just till I was sure of him. So in a blind fury, I wrote that letter. I don't know why I'm telling you now.
I suppose, said Mrs. Ansley slowly, it's because you've always gone on hating me.
Perhaps. Or because I wanted to get the whole thing off my mind.
She paused.
I'm glad you destroyed the letter. Of course, I never thought you'd die.
Mrs. Ansley relapsed into silence, and Mrs. Slade, leaning above her, was conscious of a strange sense of isolation, of being cut off from the warm current of human communion.
You think me a monster?
I don't know. It was the only letter I had, and you say he didn't write it.
How you care for him still!
I cared for that memory,
said Mrs. Ansley.
Mrs. Slade continued to look down on her.
She seemed physically reduced by the blow, as if when she got up, the wind might scatter her like a puff of dust. Mrs. Slade's jealousy suddenly leaped up again at the sight. All these years the woman had been living on that letter. How she must have loved him to treasure that mere memory of its ashes. The letter of the man her friend was engaged to. Wasn't it she who was the monster? You tried your best to get him away from me, didn't you? But you failed, and I kept him, that's all.
Yes, that's all.
I wish now I hadn't told you. I'd no idea you'd feel about it as you do. I thought you'd be amused. It all happened so long ago, as you say, and you must do me the justice to remember that I had no reason to think you'd ever taken it seriously. How could I when you were married to Horace Ansley 2 months afterward? As soon as you could get out of bed, your mother rushed you off to Florence and married you. People were rather surprised. They wondered at it being done so quickly. But I thought I knew. I had an idea you did it out of pique, to be able to say you'd got ahead of Delphin and me. Kids have such silly reasons for doing the most serious things. And your marrying so soon convinced me that you'd never really cared.
Yes, I suppose it would, Mrs. Ansley assented.
The clear heaven overhead was emptied of all its gold. Dusk spread over it, abruptly darkening the seven hills. Here and there lights began to twinkle through the foliage at their feet. Steps were coming and going on the deserted terrace, waiters looking out of the doorway at the head of the stairs, then reappearing with trays and napkins and flasks of wine. Tables were moved, chairs straightened. A feeble string of electric lights flickered out. A stout lady in a dust coat suddenly appeared, asking in broken Italian if anyone had seen the elastic band which held together her tattered Baedeker. She poked with her stick under the table at which she had lunched, the waiters assisting. The corner where Mrs. Slade and Mrs. Ansley sat was still shadowy and deserted. For a long time, neither of them spoke. At length, Mrs. Slade began again.
I suppose I did it as a sort of joke.
A joke?
Well, girls are ferocious sometimes, you know. Girls in love especially. And I remember laughing to myself all that evening at the idea that you were waiting around there in the dark, dodging out of sight, listening for every sound, trying to get in. Of course, I was upset when I heard you were so ill afterward.
Mrs. Ansley had not moved for a long time, but now she turned slowly toward her companion.
But I didn't wait. He'd arranged everything. He was there.
We were let in at once, she said. Mrs. Slade sprang up from her leaning position. Delphin there? They let you in? Oh, now you're lying, she burst out with violence.
Mrs. Ansley's voice grew clearer and full of surprise.
But of course he was there. Naturally he came. Came? How did he know he'd find you there? You must be raving.
Mrs. Ansley hesitated as though reflecting.
But I answered the letter. I told him I'd be there. So he came.
Mrs. Slade flung her hands up to her face.
Oh, God. You answered? I never thought of your answering.
It's odd you never thought of it if you wrote the letter.
Yes, I was blind with rage.
Mrs. Ansley rose and drew her fur scarf about her.
It is cold here. We'd better go.
I'm sorry for you, she said as she clasped the fur about her throat. The unexpected words sent a pang through Mrs. Slade.
Yes, we'd better go.
She gathered up her bag and cloak.
I don't know why you should be sorry for me, she muttered.
Mrs. Ansley stood looking away from her toward the dusky mass of the Colosseum.
Well, because I didn't have to wait that night.
Mrs. Slade gave an unquiet laugh.
Yes, I was beaten there. But I oughtn't to begrudge you, I suppose, at the end of all these years. After all, I had everything. I had him for 25 years, and you had nothing but
but that one letter that he didn't write." Mrs. Ansley was silent again. At length she took a step toward the door to the terrace, and turned back facing her companion. "I had Barbara," she said, and began to move ahead of Mrs. Slade toward the stairway. A Journey by Edith Wharton. As she lay in her berth, staring at the shadows overhead, the rush of the wheels was in her brain, driving her deeper and deeper into circles of wakeful lucidity. The sleeping car had sunk into its night silence. Through the wet window pane, she watched the sudden lights, the long stretches of hurrying blackness. Now and then she turned her head and looked through the opening in the hangings at her husband's curtains across the aisle. She wondered restlessly if he wanted anything, and if she could hear him if he called. His voice had grown very weak within the last months, and it irritated him when she did not hear. This irritability, this increasing childish petulance, seemed to give expression to their imperceptible estrangement. Like two faces looking at one another through a sheet of glass, they were close together, almost touching, but they could not hear or feel each other. The conductivity between them was broken. She, at least, had this sense of separation, and she fancied sometimes that she saw it reflected in the look with which he supplemented his failing words. Doubtless the fault was hers. She was too impenetrably healthy to be touched by the irrelevancies of disease. Her self-reproachful tenderness was tinged with the sense of his irrationality. She had a vague feeling that there was a purpose in his helpless tyrannies. The suddenness of the change had found her so unprepared. A year ago, their pulses had beat to one robust measure. Both had the same prodigal confidence in an exhaustless future. Now their energies no longer kept step. Hers still bounded ahead of life, preempting unclaimed regions of hope and activity, while he lagged behind, vainly struggling to overtake her. When they married, she had such arrears of living to make up. Her days had been as bare as the whitewashed schoolroom where she forced innutritious facts upon reluctant children. His coming had broken in on the slumber of circumstance, widening the present till it became the enclosure of remotest chances. But imperceptibly the horizon narrowed. Life had a grudge against her. She was never to be allowed to spread her wings. At first, the doctor had said 6 weeks of mild air would set him right. But when he came back, this assurance was explained as having, of course, included a winter in a dry climate. They gave up their pretty house, storing the wedding presents and new furniture, and went to Colorado. She had hated it there from the first. Nobody knew her or cared about her. There was no one to wonder at the good match she had made, or to envy her the new dresses and the visiting cards, which were still a surprise to her. And he kept growing worse. She felt herself beset with difficulties, too evasive to be fought by so direct a temperament. She still loved him, of course, but he was gradually, undefinably ceasing to be himself. The man she had married had been strong, active, gently masterful. The male whose pleasure it is to clear a way through the material obstructions of life. But now it was she who was the protector, he who must be shielded from inopportunities and given drops or beef juice, though the skies were falling. The routine of the sick room bewildered her. This punctual administering of medicine seemed as idle as some uncomprehended religious mummery. There were moments, indeed, when warm gushes of pity swept away her instinctive resentment of his condition, when she still found his old self in his eyes, as they groped for each other through the dense medium of his weakness. But these moments had grown rare. Sometimes he frightened her. His sunken, expressionless face seemed that of a stranger. His voice was weak and hoarse. his thin-lipped smile a mere muscular contraction. Her hand avoided his damp, soft skin, which had lost the familiar roughness of health. She caught herself furtively watching him as she might have watched a strange animal. It frightened her to feel that this was the man she loved. There were hours when to tell him what she suffered seemed the one escape from her fears. But in general, she judged herself more leniently, reflecting that she had perhaps been too long alone with him, and that she would feel differently when they were at home again, surrounded by her robust and buoyant family. How she had rejoiced when the doctors at last gave their consent to his going home. She knew, of course, what the decision meant. They both knew it. It meant that he was going to die. But they dressed the truth in hopeful euphemisms, and at time, in the joy of preparation, she really forgot the purpose of their journey and slipped into an eager allusion to next year's plans. At last the day of leaving came. She had a dreadful fear that they would never get away, that somehow at the last moment he would fail her, that the doctors held one of their accustomed treacheries in reserve. But nothing happened. They drove to the station. He was installed in a seat with a rug over his knees and a cushion at his back, and she hung out of the window waving unregretful farewells to the acquaintances she had really never liked till then. The first 24 hours had passed off well. He revived a little, and it amused him to look out the window and to observe the humours of the car. The second day he began to grow weary and chafe under the dispassionate stare of the freckled child with the lump of chewing gum. She had to explain to the child's mother that her husband was too ill to be disturbed, a statement received by that lady with the resentment visibly supported by the maternal sentiment of the whole car. That night he slept badly, and the next morning his temperature frightened her. She was sure he was growing worse. The day passed slowly, punctuated by the small irritations of travel. Watching his tired face, she traced in its contractions every rattle and jolt of the tram, till her own body vibrated with sympathetic fatigue. She felt the others observing him, too, and hovered restlessly between him and the line of interrogative eyes. The freckled child hung about him like a fly. Offers of candy and picture books failed to dislodge her. She twisted one leg around the other and watched him imperturbably. The porter, as he passed, lingered with vague proffers of help. Probably inspired by a philanthropic passenger's swelling with the sense that something ought to be done, and one nervous man in a skullcap was audibly concerned as to the possible effect on his wife's health. The hours dragged on in a dreary inoccupation. Towards dusk she sat down beside him, and he laid his hand on hers. The touch startled her. He seemed to be calling her from far off. She looked at him helplessly, and his smile went through her like a physical pang. "Are you very tired?" she asked.
"No, not very."
"We'll be there soon now."
"Yes, very soon."
"This time tomorrow." He nodded, and they sat silent. When she put him to bed and crawled into her own berth, she tried to cheer herself with the thought that in less than 24 hours they would be in New York. Her people would all be at the station to meet her. She pictured their round, unanxious faces pressing through the crowd. She only hoped they would not tell him too loudly that he was looking splendidly and would be all right in no time. The subtler sympathies developed by long contact with suffering were making her aware of a certain coarseness of texture in the familial sensibilities. Suddenly she thought she heard him call. She parted the curtains and listened. No, it was only a man snoring at the other end of the car. His snores had a greasy sound, as though they passed through tallow. She lay down and tried to sleep. Had she not heard him move? She started up, trembling. The silence frightened her more than any sound. He might not be able to make her hear. He might be calling her now. Oh, what made her think of such things? It was merely the familiar tendency of an overtired mind to fasten itself on the most intolerable chance within the range of its forebodings. Putting her head out, she listened. But she could not distinguish his breathing from that of the other pairs of lungs about her. She longed to get up and look at him, but she knew the impulse was a mere vent for her restlessness, and the fear of her disturbing him restrained her. The regular movement of his curtain reassured her, she knew not why. She remembered that he had wished her a cheerful good night, and the sheer inability to endure her fears a moment longer made her put them from her with an effort of her whole sound, tired body. She turned on her side and slept. She sat up stiffly, staring out at the dawn. The train was rushing through a region of bare hillocks huddled against a lifeless sky. It looked like the first day of creation. The air of the car was close, and she pushed up her window to let in the keen wind. Then she looked at her watch. It was 7 o'clock, and soon the people about her would be stirring. She slipped into her clothes, smoothed her disheveled hair, and crept to the dressing room. When she had washed her face and adjusted her dress, she felt more hopeful. It was always a struggle for her not to be cheerful in the morning. Her cheeks burned deliciously under the coarse towel, and the wet hair about her temples broke into strong upward tendrils. Every inch of her was full of life and elasticity. And in 10 hours they would be at home. She stepped to her husband's berth. It was time for him to take his early glass of milk. The window shade was down, and in the dusk of the curtained enclosure, she could just see that he lay sideways, with his face away from her. She leaned over him and drew up the shade. As she did so, she touched one of his hands. It felt cold. She bent closer, laying her hand on his arm and calling him by name. He did not move. She spoke again, more loudly. She grasped his shoulders and gently shook it. He lay motionless. She caught hold of his hand again. It slipped from her limply, like a dead thing. A dead thing? Her breath caught. She must see his face. She leaned forward and hurriedly, shrinkingly, with the sickening reluctance of the flesh, laid her hands on his shoulders and turned him over. He fell back. His face looked small and smooth. He gazed at her with steady eyes. She remained motionless for a long time, holding him thus, and they looked at each other. Suddenly she shrank back. The longing to scream, to call out, to fly from him had almost overpowered her. But a strong hand arrested her. Oh, good God! If it were known that he was dead, they would be put off the train at the next station. In a terrifying flash of remembrance, there rose before her a scene she had once witnessed in traveling, when a husband and wife whose child had died in the train had been thrust out at some chance station. She saw them standing on the platform with the child's body between them. She had never forgotten the dazed look with which they followed the receding train. And this was what would happen to her. Within the next hour, she might find herself on the platform of some strange station, alone with her husband's body. Anything but that. It was too horrible. She quivered like a creature at bay. As she cowered there, she felt the train moving more slowly. It was coming then. They were approaching a station. She saw again the husband and wife standing on the lonely platform, and with a violent gesture she drew down the shade to hide her husband's face. Feeling dizzy, she sank down on the edge of the berth, keeping away from his outstretched body, and pulling the curtain close so that he and she were shut into a kind of sepulchre twilight. She tried to think. At all costs, she must conceal the fact that he was dead. But how? Her mind refused to act. She could not plan, combine. She could think of no way but to sit there clutching the curtains all day long. She heard the porter making up her bed. People were beginning to move about the car. The dressing room door was being opened and shut. She tried to rouse herself. At length, with the supreme effort, she rose to her feet, stepping into the aisle of the car and drawing the curtains tight behind her. She noticed that they still parted slightly with the motion of the car, and finding a pin in her dress, she fastened them together. Now she was safe. She looked round and saw the porter. She fancied he was watching her.
"Ain't he awake yet?" he inquired.
"No," she faltered.
"I got his milk all ready when he wants it. You know, you told me to have it for him by 7.
She nodded silently and crept into her seat. At 8:30, the train reached Buffalo. By this time, the other passengers were dressed and the berths had been folded back for the day. The porter, moving to and fro under his burden of sheets and pillows, glanced at her as he passed. At length, he said,
"Ain't he going to get up? You know, we're ordered to make up the berths as early as we can."
She turned cold with fear. They were just entering the station. "Oh, no, not yet," she stammered. "Not till he's had his milk. Won't you get it, please?"
"All right, as soon as we start again."
When the train moved, he reappeared with the milk. She took it from him and sat vaguely looking at it. Her brain moved slowly from one idea to another, as though they were stepping stones set far apart across a whirling flood. At length, she became aware that the porter still hovered expectantly.
"Will I give it to him?" he suggested.
"Oh, no," she cried, rising. "He's asleep yet, I think." She waited until the porter had passed on. Then she unpinned the curtains and slipped behind them. In the semi-obscurity, her husband's face stared up at her like a marble mask with agate eyes. The eyes were dreadful. She put out her hand and drew down the lids. Then she remembered the glass of milk in her other hand. What was she to do with it? She thought of raising the window and throwing it out, but to do so she would have to lean across his body and bring her face close to his. She decided to drink the milk. She returned to her seat with the empty glass, and after a while the porter came to get it.
"When'll I fold up the bed?" he asked.
"Oh, not now, not yet. He's ill. He's very ill. Can't you let him stay as he is? The doctor wants him to lie down as much as possible."
He scratched his head. "Well, if he's really sick..."
He took the empty glass and walked away, explaining to the passengers that the party behind the curtain was too sick to get up just yet. She found herself the center of sympathetic eyes. A motherly woman with an intimate smile sat down beside her.
"I'm really sorry to hear your husband sick. I've had a remarkable amount of sickness in my family, and maybe I could assist you. Can I take a look at him?"
"Oh, no, no, please. He mustn't be disturbed." The lady accepted the rebuff indulgently.
"Well, it's just as you say, of course, but you don't look to me as if you'd had much experience in sickness, and I'd have been glad to assist you. What do you generally do when your husband's taken this way?"
I let him sleep."
"Well, too much sleep ain't any too healthful either. Don't you give him any medicine?"
"Yes."
"Well, don't you wake him to take it?"
"Yes."
"When does he take the next dose?"
"Not for 2 hours." The lady looked disappointed.
"Well, if I was you, I'd try to give it oftener. That's what I do with my folks."
After that, many faces seemed to press upon her. Their voices went on and on, like bell buoys droning through a fog. The porter came up now and then with questions that she did not understand, and that somehow she must have answered since he went away again without repeating them. Every 2 hours the motherly lady reminded her that her husband ought to have his drops. People left the car and others replaced them. Her head was spinning, and she tried to steady herself by clutching at her thoughts as they swept by, but they slipped away from her like bushes on the side of a sheer precipice, down which she seemed to be falling. Suddenly her mind grew clear again, and she found herself vividly picturing what would happen when the train reached New York. She shuddered as it occurred to her that he would be quite cold, and that someone might perceive he had been dead since morning. She thought hurriedly, "If they see I am not surprised, they will suspect something. They will ask questions. and if I tell them the truth, they won't believe me. No one would believe me. It would be terrible. And she kept repeating to herself, I must pretend I don't know. I must pretend I don't know. When the curtain opens, I must go up to him quite naturally, and then I must scream. She had an idea that the scream would be very hard to do. Gradually, new thoughts crowded upon her, vivid and urgent. She tried to separate and restrain them, but they beset her clamorously, like her schoolchildren at the end of a hot day when she was too tired to silence them. Her head grew confused, and she felt a sick fear of forgetting her part, of betraying herself by some unguarded word or look. I must pretend I don't know, she went on, murmuring. The words had lost their significance, but she repeated them mechanically, as though they had been a magic formula, until suddenly she heard herself saying, I can't remember, I can't remember. Her voice sounded very loud, and she looked about her in terror, but no one seemed to notice that she had spoken. She roused herself with a shiver. Had she fainted or slept? Hours seemed to have elapsed, but it was still broad day, and the people about her were sitting in the same attitudes as before. A sudden sense of hunger made her aware that she had eaten nothing since morning. The thought of food filled her with disgust, but she dreaded a return to faintness. And remembering that she had biscuits in her bag, she took one out and ate it. The dry crumbs choked her, and she hastily swallowed a little brandy from her husband's flask. The burning sensation in her throat acted as a counter-irritant, momentarily relieving the dull ache of her nerves. Then she felt a gently stealing warmth, as though a soft air fanned her, and the swarming fears relaxed their clutch, receding through the stillness that enclosed her, a stillness soothing as the spacious quietude of a summer day. She slept. Through her sleep, she felt the impetuous rush of the train. It seemed to be life itself that was sweeping her on with headlong, inexorable force, sweeping her into darkness and terror and the awe of unknown days. Now, all at once, everything was still. Not a sound, not a pulsation. She was dead in her turn, and lay beside him with smooth, upstaring face. How quiet it was! And yet she heard feet coming, the feet of men who were to carry them away. She could feel, too. She felt a sudden, prolonged vibration, a series of hard shocks, and then another plunge into darkness. The darkness of death this time. A black whirlwind on which they were both spinning like leaves, in wild, uncoiling spirals, with millions and millions of the dead. She sprang up in terror. Her sleep must have lasted a long time, for the winter day had paled and the lights had been lit. The car was in confusion, and as she regained her self-possession, she saw that the passengers were gathering up their wraps and bags. The porter passed down the aisle with his impartial brush. An impersonal figure with a gold-banded cap asked for her husband's ticket. Presently her window was blocked by an expanse of sooty wall, and the train passed into Harlem Tunnel. The journey was over. In a few minutes she would see her family pushing joyously through the throng at the station. Her heart dilated. The worst terror was past.
"We'd better get him up now, hadn't we?" asked the porter, touching her arm.
He had her husband's hat in his hand and was meditatively revolving it under his brush. She looked at the hat and tried to speak, but suddenly the car grew dark. She flung up her arms, struggling to catch at something, and fell face downward, striking her head against the dead man's berth. And that's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed these stories by Edith Wharton. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.